for the approximately 2 million people living with atrial fibrillation, commonly known as AFib, comes the reality that they are more than 70% likely to die of a stroke. While we can often understand the physical responses to illness, we too often overlook the emotional responses. Today's guest is here to help us understand the emotional impact of AFib. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest is Dr. Christopher R. Ellis of Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Ellis is a cardiovascular disease specialist, and he has over 18 years of diverse experience, particularly in the area of cardiology. Dr. Ellis, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start off with what AFib actually is. What is atrial fibrillation?
That is a good question, actually. First, it's certainly the most common arrhythmia that we manage, increasingly frequent as patients age. It is an irregular heart rhythm that lacks the coordinated beating from the top and bottom chambers in the heart, and manifests mainly through irregularity in the pulse and then a variety of symptoms that patients may or may not attribute to, oh, that's AFib, but it may actually be from the arrhythmia. It's just no coordinated electrical contraction in the top chamber, kind of a quivering in the atrium. I usually describe it to patients, if you thought about when you were watching television and turn to a channel that doesn't have reception, all of a sudden you go from a nice clear picture to white noise. And that's kind of what has happened when the heart goes into AFib.
What are some of the symptoms that folks might typically ignore that could be associated with AFib?
Yeah, well, in my practice, the majority of what I do is manage AFib, and I've seen all kinds of a spectrum of symptoms. If the heart rate is really going fast in AFib, people can certainly feel a fluttering in the chest or a pulse that is really rapid if they were able to feel their pulse. A lot of patients can't feel that, so they notice something like just a profound lack of energy or their normal activity that they're used to doing, maybe going out, walking to the mailbox and back, particularly if there's inclines, they may feel like, oh, I'm a lot more short of breath or that was more difficult than I remember. So it can be a subtle change in your exertional, in your ability to exercise or exert yourself. Some patients will notice that they actually urinate a lot when they go into AFib. They may have wild swings in their blood pressure if they're a patient with high blood pressure, and they track that at home carefully. And then some people may just notice fatigue. You know, they just feel tired, like they're not sure that anything specific was wrong, but they just haven't felt well. And I'll see that a lot where a patient gets picked up, say getting a colonoscopy or some other interface with the medical community. They're found to be in AFib and they didn't know it. And then once normal rhythm is restored, they all of a sudden appreciate all the symptoms that they had. And are like, oh, that must have been AFib. So it can be subtle, and it can be something dramatic like presenting with a stroke or presenting with heart failure.
Are there any gender differences or racial differences in who is likely to experience AFib?
The most common thing we can put our finger on as far as like a genetic component is, or a inherited thing, is really your age. So AFib definitely increases in frequency as patients age. If we look at comorbid stuff like other medical conditions, definitely the big three are high blood pressure, sleep apnea, and obesity. There's been some really nice studies of intervening on those factors. And, if you can get your blood pressure consistently below 130 on the top number, if you, I didn't know, but you get tested and treated for sleep apnea, or you working on diet and exercise are able to get your body mass index or BMI below 30, those targets seem to make a big impact on reducing someone's AFib. So there's those conditions. Now, other diet factors, definitely alcohol consumption is unfortunately quite well linked to AFib, and pretty much every increasing number of sort of a drink a day, 2 drinks a day, 3 drinks a day, you see a rise in the frequency of AFib. So those are the big things like we can definitely put our finger on. Now there are genes that give you a family tendency for AFib, and they probably double the chances of you getting it. So some of that can be inherited. Women live longer than men, so they will get AFib. There is definitely, though, a lot of bias when we get to the treatment for AFib, that women are underrepresented in clinical trials on new therapies for AFib, and both racial and gender bias exists in, proper treatment, just getting people on a blood thinner or trying to address the rhythm. So
So it
those are
sounds
factors
like
that we certainly see.
it kind of sounds like as you age, it would be unusual if you didn't have AFib. Am I understanding you correctly? Particularly if you're a
Well,
woman?
maybe. It depends. Sure, it depends how hard you look. We certainly look at a 10% or higher rate of AFib at age 80. But picking up AFib, like if you don't know you have AFib and we don't have some kind of heart monitor that is tracking all your heartbeats, we probably miss a lot of AFib. So as we've started looking closer, certainly patients are getting involved with this with your own cardiac monitor watches and detection products. Patients come in a lot of times like following their blood pressure and they see irregularity on the heart rate monitor, or something is more high tech is like an Apple Watch or the Cardia mobile device. People can certainly pick up that they have AFib, and we start seeing more of that. When we put a continuous heart monitor in people, like we call it a loop recorder, but actually it's a tiny little thing that goes under the skin, and it can monitor the heart rhythm 24 hours a day for 3 or 4 years. It's quite remarkable how often we pick up AFib, and patients had no idea. The incidence is at least 10% of the prevalence after age 80. So I wouldn't say everybody's going to get AFib, but certainly all of the extra factors that I discussed previously are becoming more prevalent. So we, the frequency of atrial fib across the population is definitely increasing.
Dr. Ellis, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to focus on the emotional responses people have when they are aware that they have AFib. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Dr. Ellis, I would imagine that you have seen a range of emotional responses when people receive the diagnosis of AFib. What are some of the more common ones, if there are more common ones, that you've experienced?
Sure. Well, I think most patients, the first thing that they're concerned about and that definitely has an impact on their emotional well-being would be the fear of having a stroke. I think, again, because we're dealing with a arrhythmia that is common, many people I see that we start talking about AFib and what it means to them, a lot of times they'll relay even a personal story of someone they know that's had a stroke, you know, mom, dad, a friend. So it's an immediate concern, and preventing stroke becomes, you know, the primary thing that we talk about usually on a first consult with a patient, because it's going to be a lifelong thing. Like, unfortunately, we don't have a great way to cure AFib. So if we know you have it, we have to address over your lifetime, how do we reduce the chances of you having a stroke? So that's one thing that I think people certainly note. And then a lot of patients I see, especially around our area, that like to, you know, get out in the community and see their friends and go shopping and do whatever, feel like they're always a little bit concerned that they're about to have another AFib attack, especially if they have a lot of symptoms from it and really feel miserable when it happens. Because there are some triggers we talked about that you know you're going to put yourself in AFib, but for the most part, the rhythm just pops up out of nowhere, you know, right at the worst time. At holiday party, at, you know, an interview, or you're out on a date, or what have you. It's restricting and limiting to the patient to think about, you know, am I going to go into AFib? And so constantly a little bit of a feeling there. And then I also think just in terms of seeing patients like really enjoying what they want to be doing, you know, playing golf, what have you. Certainly a lot of patients I see are still very active and have a lot of times very impressive hobbies, even in retirement, and they just feel like they can't do that to its fullest when they're stuck in AFib. So it impacts multiple parts of the patient emotionally.
So anytime someone is experiencing a chronic, almost anything, but certainly a chronic illness, there is increased potential for depression. It sounds like what you're saying with AFib is that depression and anxiety is almost a very normal, almost expected potential response upon receiving that diagnosis. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's first of all, no. I mean, the two big things that I think most patients worry about getting is like heart disease and cancer, because those are the things that, you know, really have a huge impact on both your quality of life and your length of life. So, you know, in that way, I think patients are very, are going to be very concerned about a diagnosis of AFib. And it's, again, like I said, if it was something where, we could easily cure it, you know, maybe that would put a lot of people's minds at ease. But when we start talking about treatment options, anywhere from medical therapy to heart rhythm drugs to ablations and pacemakers and other options to try to control the AFib, I think, you know, that becomes quickly a realization for someone that it's really a chronic disease. And so it's something that they're going to have to continue to deal with.
What about the emotional impact on people around, the family or friends or even colleagues, if they choose to share it with an employer. Do you notice any particular trend in terms of those responses?
Well, we'll see some, you know, if patients are in a real physically demanding job, let's say, and they get AFib at a young age, it certainly can impact their quality of being able to perform their work. So in that way, you know, it's not, I don't know that I want to say that it can be disabling, but it can certainly impact, you know, what you're going to try to do in your profession, both mentally and physically. So it can be physically exhausting and mentally exhausting.
You just said, particularly if you have someone who's young and has been diagnosed with AFib, mm-hmm. What is considered young for a diagnosis of AFib?
Probably less than 50.
Okay.
I mean, most of the time, so we deal with mostly patients between probably 55 and 85 in terms of symptomatic AFib that's affecting their lifestyle, affecting their quality of life, and they are looking for treatments to try to do better. So it's a little bit unusual to see people in their 40s and 30s, but I would say I'm seeing more of that than I used to. I can't put my finger on why, but it certainly is something we're seeing, more young patients getting AFib.
Do you suggest that someone with a diagnosis of AFib get some sort of support, whether it's a support group or working with a psychotherapist or whatever feels supportive to them, to help ward off or manage ensuing depression or anxiety, or no?
Well, there's actually a couple really interesting studies in some of our impact cardiology journals. One of them actually shows that if you regularly participate in yoga, the symptoms and the burden of your arrhythmia is significantly reduced. So stress reduction is a definite help in terms of limiting the progression of the AFib. So exercise, definitely good. Exercise is also the only real proven strategy to help reduce dementia. So as you can imagine, if you have AFib and are prone to strokes or mini strokes and dementia, perhaps, you know, regular daily exercise is going to certainly help neurologically keep you from getting in bad shape. And so those are definitely components. I mean, the stress and anxiety component to it, it's not that I would say, you know, we would think about treating AFib with Zoloft, but I think getting support so that you feel like you can accept the diagnosis and deal with the symptoms and still enjoy your life, that's definitely an important aspect.
What kind of exercises would you say are useful for someone with a diagnosis of AFib? You've mentioned yoga. Is that...
That is... Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good option. I think it's going to depend a bit on your, you know, your personal capacity for that, depending on... I mean, we see a big overlap, as I talked about, with the increasing obesity and increasing AFib, that a lot of patients have significant arthritis trouble, and, you know, telling them to get out and jog is not going to happen. Certainly, the goal would be to try to get your heart rate up to about 60 or 70% of your maximum heart rate. So you can calculate that as 220 and then minus your age. So say for a 70-year-old person, 150 would be your peak heart rate, and so your exercise heart rate you'd like to get to would be maybe 110. And if you can do that for 20 or 30 minutes, that's going to get you the aerobic benefit. But there's still just getting out and walking 20, 30 minutes a day is a great benefit. And for many patients that I see, because we're trying to work on their weight in addition, you know, I really counsel folks, like, after you eat dinner, I don't know if you have a dog or not, but get out and walk the dog for half an hour. You know, get up and move. Get your blood flowing after a meal. It'll help you digest. It'll help you get some of the weight off. You'll metabolize it instead of just flopping on the couch and then going to bed. And, you know, so daily regular walking, whatever you're doing, the goal is to try to at least get your heart rate up for about 20 or 30 minutes a day if you can.
One of the things that I noticed as I was doing some research into your background is the way that your patients appreciate the time and the attention that you take with them. I'm wondering what it's like for you to work with folks who, just by virtue of your practice, you kind of know that they're going to be a little bit troubled, they're going to be a little worried. It's not a diagnosis that they necessarily want to hear or think about. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to really hear more about the impact of all of this on you, just as a human being, in addition to being a doctor. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Dr. Ellis, tell us a little bit about how all of this impacts Dr. Ellis.
Well, that's an interesting question. So I'm in my mid-40s. My parents are both in their mid-70s. And mom and dad both have AFib. And so and really they got it while I was in my practice. So as I've been managing a lot of patients and creating some wonderful bonds with many of the folks that we've been able to take care of, I've seen what happens to certain patients over time in certain situations, and it always, you know, makes me a little concerned. But I get to use that back with my patients. A lot of times I'll tell patients, you know, we're going to help protect you from stroke, because I would be really worried about my parents having a stroke. And I laugh because my mom is on Eliquis and my dad is on Xarelto. I tell people that, you know, I'm going to put you on Eliquis, and I put my mom on it, and I love my mother. And most patients, you know, they get a kick out of that. On the flip side, seeing some of the things that when I'm really trying, it's a really disturbing thing to me when, you know, one of my patients does have a stroke, and it does happen. I mean, a lot of reasons for that. Sometimes it's something simple, like they had to get a tooth pulled and came off blood thinners for a few days and then had a stroke. But it's been a little more difficult just watching as my parents age. Like my dad took a spill at his house on his steps, and being on the blood thinner, I mean, he was bruised up from head to toe. And you see that and don't think that's like a really dangerous thing. But, you know, now he's like afraid to walk around his house. He just kind of hasn't been the same. And I think a lot of patients, I see the same kind of emotional response to being on blood thinners, where it's like restricting their ability to just live their life and get out and do things. And so having seen that from a patient's side, and then also, you know, with my parents as they've aged and had difficulties with the blood thinners too, it's been something I'm not looking forward to, but I can kind of see that there's a good chance I'm going to have AFib too. So
So that's a challenge in and of itself. You talked about blood thinners, and just the minute or two we have left, are there other options that are generally available that someone can use in terms of a treatment method?
Sure. Yeah, mostly we look at a series of risk factors to predict if you have a high enough risk for stroke and AFib, we're likely to prescribe a blood thinner. It's guideline directed, and and we know it saves lives and that prevents strokes, but all blood thinners can cause significant bleeding problems. And you know, there's the issue of you have to take the medicine, you got to be able to afford the medicine, and you can't interrupt the medicine. So increasingly in the last 4 or 5 years, a huge part of my practice has been working with stroke protection devices, which are really starting to become more commonly used as an alternative to blood thinners. And for some of my patients, it's one of the biggest success stories and really a great patient satisfaction story when we're able to stop blood thinners for that patient safely. You know, they really appreciate that. And many folks that I'm encountering are in a real difficult situation and don't have a lot of options. But there's several different ways, but the concept is to seal off this little part of the heart muscle called the left atrial appendage. And for most patients, probably 9 out of 10, that would be the source of where a stroke would come from. So if we can deal with it by sealing it off, then you don't really need to be on the blood thinner any longer for AFib. So that's something that really only in the last 4 or 5 years has become more widely available and definitely an option. And I think a lot of patients and a lot of doctors still don't really understand that there are good, safe options to replace blood thinners.
Dr. Ellis, I want to thank you so much for spending your time and sharing your expertise with us today. If someone listening wants to know more about, for example, the stroke protection devices you just mentioned, or learn more about AFib in general, mm-hmm. do you have a recommendation for where they can go?
Yeah, one definitely patient-friendly option is the Watch Us Now website. So it's www.watchusnow.com. And that has some interesting sort of patient survey type guided education on use of blood thinners and AFib. There's also the Heart Rhythm Society has several patient-centered website links, and also the stopafib.org is another good place for patients to go. They actually have a really nice conference as well once a year where a lot of experts come in to talk about AFib, and you can, you know, sign up and go and get a lot of education, and also you can ask questions in an open forum.
Wonderful. Again, Dr. Christopher R. Ellis of Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Pam.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is always available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. And remember, too, that we have weekly free giveaways, so make sure you sign up for the giveaway at MindTalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.